Blue Boat Home really reaches deep for whatever reason. I can never figure out why it's so powerful. Our message for the day is climate, community, and cucumbers. Be careful what you wish for. I was one of the people in February wishing for an early spring. It came the last few days in February. It got up to, I believe, 80 degrees, and the peach trees were budding, and large mosquitoes actually were beginning to bite. And it was reported people were coming out in flip-flops and shorts and floral shirts, and you know the routine. And then along came the northern front of the weather, and temperatures dropped to 15 degrees. Well, we're finally in the final week now of April, and I think we've made it official this time. Anyway, I can feel the sap is beginning to flow in my legs as well as some of my plants. April is a very busy time. I hope you can kind of appreciate we're trying to pay our taxes. Hopefully you have that done. We're out there cutting grass, if that power mower will start. Sometimes it does the first time, sometimes not. Easter family gatherings, and we're trying to figure out what's going on with the Cardinals. Are they going to bring it together this year or not? We're busy people, but even busy people, it's hard to ignore Mother Nature in April time. The Cardinals, that's the other kind with feathers. They're out there busy building nests, mating, and catching insects out there. And the beauty and the mystery, looking up in the starry night, that can stir quite a bit of passion in our hearts. A little walk along a woods may surround us with pink and blue flowers. If you're lucky, maybe you'll find a few morel mushrooms hanging out around in those places. And it's been rumored that some gardeners now are putting the four S's together. I think that's sun, seed, soil, some sweat, and they're producing these little green miracles right in their backyard. As we know, as of yet, there's no app for anything like that. If the birds don't get your attention, Mother Nature can resort to a few cracks of thunder, bolts of lightning, or the threat of wind or tornadoes. It's not nice to fool Mother Nature out there. But there's a second story we're going to address today. It's not what Mother Nature does for us, but what we're doing to Mother Nature. Evidence, and we know what evidence is. All the marching was going on yesterday suggesting evidence is important for us. It's piling up that humanity is overwhelming the natural forces on Earth. On this 47th year of Earth Day, we must ask ourselves, are humans, that's us, putting the health of the planet and future generations at risk? Pope Francis has already touched on this in the encyclical, and I'm going to quote a few sentences from the Pope. We are not faced with two separate crises, one environmental and the other social, but rather one complex crisis, which is both social and environmental. Strategies for a solution demand an integrated approach to combating poverty, restoring dignity to the underprivileged, and at the same time, protecting nature. I'm going to do a UU speak on that. The two biggest challenges facing humankind, the two gorillas in the room, if you will, is climate change and increasing gap of income inequality. Both are inseparable. You can't deal with one without dealing with the other. Communities of faith, and I think us, you in particular, we already know that. We have a moral voice for equality for all people, and also as saving all life. So we have two crises then. That one crisis is climate change. Some of us from the old school used to call that global warming. I like to call it weather weirding. Of all the issues, deforestation, toxic waste, acid rain, ocean dead zones, those are terms my parents would have had no clue what those were about at their time. Of all the things going on, probably climate change is the most threatening and the most complex. Those fossil fuels, that's the things that gave us economic growth out there, oil, gas, natural gas. When you burn these things, CO2 is released in the atmosphere faster than Mother Nature can recycle it. And despite the warnings going on for 20, perhaps 30 years, gases continue to rise. As a result, Mother Nature is now running a fever or a temperature. The solar ice shields are melting. The glaciers are doing the same thing. And hotter summers, More droughts and rain bombs. I've never heard of rain bombs before. Dave Murray was talking. That's why sometimes we have these massive unexpected floodings of 4 or 5 inches of rain within an hour. But it's business as usual. And then we have this second crisis going on, and that's connected though to climate change. And that is the global economy converts nature into a multi-million dollar market, but poverty will continue to persist out there. About 25% of the world's population travels first class. That includes many of us here. That means we have more than enough food, probably meat eaters. We have energy, housing, health care, and we have our cars. And we drink beer out of aluminum cans. The bottom 25% are traveling third class. They're undernourished. If they have water, it's contaminated. They have no medical treatment. They have shorter lifespans, and they're hopeless. They are powerless. Planet-wide, there's an increasing concentration of wealth in the upper 5% of humanity. Now, both issues are called wicked problems. I only bring that up because I wanted to say wicked in the unit. It just sounds like the right thing to say. By wicked, we mean evil. These problems may not have solutions. They can only be managed. We may not know what the solutions might be. The experts, our government leaders, they don't agree on what the root causes are, nor do they agree what the solutions might be. Hence that notion of wicked, very complex. And on top of that, there are few, if any, technological solutions. What it means is we will have to change our behaviors and our values and our perceptions. We don't like the change. Why care about climate change? I know a number of folks up here have unplugged some things. We have gotten more efficient cars out there. We eat some organic food. We grow a few tomatoes. We have donated some money to some causes out there. We have volunteered. We may have even emailed our congresspeople out there now and then. I've cared, but sometimes climate change, as well as the income gap, it seems just too big, too distant, and no solutions out there. And by the way, what does all this have to do with my life? As you can tell, we swing from involved to helplessness to maybe denial in terms of all these problems. We're much more troubled by threats we can imagine, that we can mentally conjure up a picture. A terrorist planting a bomb, a thief with a gun, an asteroid hurling towards Earth. This last one is going to miss by a few million miles, they tell me, are a swarm of zombies. I'm not sure what the zombies are, but some people are concerned about that. So where's a good place to start? And I think a good place to start is probably going to our national leaders in Washington, D.C. I'm kidding. It's the concentration of political and economic power. There's something different in Washington, D.C. on Earth Day 27 compared to the first Earth Day in 1970. In 1970, global warming was on the radar for only a few scattered scientists in the process. But on the other hand, Washington was persuaded by the concentrated power of nearly 20 million people taking to the streets. Now these people, 20 million, they had no tweets. That was before tweets. They only had bumper stickers. Make love, not war, power to the people. And one bumper sticker that has survived nearly five decades is, think globally, act locally. We're still trying to figure out how to do that. That's a complex issue. The White House in 1970, that's Richard Nixon, and Congress responded with a 100% vote to support the Environmental Protection Agency. 100 votes for clean air and clean water. Today, Congress and the White House can only construct walls or gridlock. I'm going to climb out on an optimistic branch or limb that climate progress will be made with or without Washington. Already, I see some grand things going on. Alton, Granite City, Edwardsville, they have become cool cities. And what that means is, and this church was responsible in part for Alton becoming a cool city, is that citizens working along with the city, they pledged to become energy efficient. They do a CO2 benchmarking, and they try to make their buildings more efficient and their vehicles more efficient in the process. And by the way, when you save energy for the city, you also save money, and they get interested. I was amazed in Alton alone when they converted their stoplights, the electric bill, when they changed those to LED lighting, they saved now $15,000 a year, as well as CO2. Before, I had no idea there was even a power bill for traffic signals out there. In addition, already we've seen about 150 coal-fired plants. Those are electric plants that produce coal, are either shutting down or converting to natural gas, because people like Mary and David have installed solar panels, and that's helping move us along the way out there. So we're going to make progress with or without Washington in the start. I think perhaps one of the best places to start are in our own communities. That might be the sweet spot. Just like the Goldilocks Bears, I think they had chairs in there. Some chairs were too big. Well, Washington is too big. Some chairs are too small. That's you and I by our own. So the good right chair, the medium size, is our communities out there. In a community where people feel connected, protected, and respected, you can think of that as CPR, trust will develop. We work together and we build civil muscle. We create communities that are better to live, work, and play, and better for the environment. And when I say community, what comes to your mind? I'm a little intimidated by actually literally asking you what comes to your mind. Lots of things: taxes, schools, unaffordable housing, Edwardsville, Florissant. Sometimes when I think communities, I think of some places my wife and I have traveled to communities that we've really connected with. Santa Fe is one of those. Portland is another. Asheville, probably Madison, Wisconsin. Oh, I have mixed feelings there about returning back there. But these are interesting cities. When we were building roads here, they were building bicycle trails and walking trails in the process. I was intrigued by, in a number of these areas, people still shop their streets out there, and you find a mix of people of ages and ethnic mix, and they really seem to work. And I'm wondering, can we take some of the things they do at those communities and bring them back to make our communities even better places in the process? By the way, a few of those communities, like Santa Fe or Boulder, Colorado, I really have to go back there and live. So I went back there, and I found out everybody else wanted to live there, too. Housing prices were expensive, and few jobs were available. So I don't think there's a cookie-cutter formula for making our community like those places. Indeed, we can't. Our communities are unique. But it seems like a good home in a safe neighborhood, convenient to jobs, good schools, and a huge church wouldn't be a bad thing to add, would head us in the right direction. And I wanted to explore maybe just a few principles that might help us move our communities to make them even better places to live. And these principles, I think, are a lot like the UU principles you mentioned out there. In fact, what I'm going to talk about doesn't seem too out of the extraordinary, because I think we UU people already are thinking in terms of our communities and what makes them good places to live. But one of the first things I put is to put people first. Not the economy, not roads, but put people at the center. Several weeks ago, I went to a seminar called Madison County Summit, and I think it was a very important one to go to. But they put economics first. They put roads first. They want our economy to grow, and they have the notion this will solve all of our problems. I'd like to have them state people first. The relationships, often they're invisible, they're the glue that holds our community together. And I think, first of all, we just have to improve our connections with people around us. This means terror of terror, meeting our neighbors, and maybe meeting some strangers who live in our communities. It turns out that being neighborly is something of an art that we've kind of lost, America. I'm going to quote an expert on that, Mr. Rogers. Won't you be my neighbor? There's something profound there. So we need to sit at the table and discuss and learn from each other what we want, what our needs are, what it's going to take to make this place a more attractive place to live, better for the environment, better for the economy. I just put a little side note here. Our communities are at a demographic crossroads. The majority white will be one of many minorities. And when we sit at these tables to find out where we want to go in our community, we really need to embrace diversity. That's you all over again. We've been getting that message for 20, 30 years, perhaps. At these gathering places, in terms of race, nationality, religion, sexual orientation, economic status, all members must be welcomed at this table. A second principle for making our communities better is to make healthy choices easy. A livable community should be a healthy community. One number stands out about all the others as the best indicator at the health. If you're fortunate to have a doctor and you go there for your yearly checkup, you get blood pressure numbers, you get your sugar levels, you get your cholesterol levels. But one of the best numbers that indicates health is your zip code. Medical evidence shows that people living in certain zip codes face greater health risks and higher mortalities. The link between a clean, green community and physical mental health has been well established. An urban design that results in sedentary lifestyles, polluted air, food deserts, contributes to heart disease, diabetes, and mental stress and depression. When Farmer Surgeon General Murty was asked what was the biggest disease in America, without hesitating, he answered, "It's not cancer, it's not heart disease, it's social isolation, the greatest pathology of our lives today," according to him. These pages will come apart. And I think there's a bit of irony. We live around thousands of people out there, but at times we can feel isolated. And particularly vulnerable, I think, are older adults who have lost friends, lost family, and sometimes the ability to drive, and that really can isolate us. But I think we're all vulnerable to social isolation, and a vibrant community has to have a lot of public places. They could be libraries, they could be churches, they could be coffee shops, they could be corner parks, use your imagination, so that young people, older people, and strangers can mix and mingle. When we mix and mingle, we get to know each other. We get to know each other, we begin to trust people. And when we trust people, we can accomplish great things in our community. A third principle I put in here to make our communities more livable, more healthy, is mobility and transportation. One of the biggest challenges to a livable community is 50 years of automobile-dominating planning. We have built our communities around the automobile. Cars aren't going away. But just between you and I can't imagine letting my car go. I'm working on it. But cars are expensive pets. They cost an average of $12,000 a year to maintain. They degrade air quality. For every mile I drive, I'm throwing out a pound and a half of CO2. I wouldn't think about throwing any wrappers out the window, but we do throw CO2 out there in the process. Also, for people on foot or on bicycles, cars cause problems out there. I'm amazed at the pedestrian incidents of accidents going up, particularly for the very young and the very old out there. And by the way, Alton, like Edwardsville and a lot of other places downtown, we pave over about 40% of our green space with asphalt and concrete, just so we can take care of that automobiles out there. That same Surgeon General Murty challenged all communities to become more walkable. Opportunities to walk to stores, cafes, schools, and maybe even church. AARP, have you heard of those folks? Okay. They're really getting into walkability and living in place. And they now do walkable audits. They just had a mini one here in Alton. And they use an 880 formula. And by 880, if I'm 8 years old or if I'm 80 years old, can I walk to the park? Can I take my bicycle to the corner store and get a brownie mix? And they figure if you can do that, if you're 8 or 80, everybody in between are going to be doing okay. What happened to that corner store, by the way, to go get the brownie mix? It doesn't exist. We need the freedom to choose how we're going to get around. Choices that encourage physical activity, less air pollution, and a few green spaces, not paved with asphalt. It's good for our health, it's good for the planet, and it's probably good for our pocketbook. By the way, Madison County, I think, is making some good inroads on that. Are you amazed by the bicycle hiking trails we have around? That's something, once again, I'm a UU, I don't believe in miracles, but these trails are pretty close to that in the process, and they're getting better. We have a bus system that's trying to do better and trying to get people to where they work or at off hours they're working around. And Alton, at least in this area, we're getting the new Amtrak station. That's public transportation. It's Amtrak, and they use the word multimodal. I'm getting used to it. It means buses go there, our cars go there, we can bicycle there. I'm optimistic on this area. The cars will not go away. A fourth principle would be local foods. We need to connect farmers and consumers together. Illinois has 26 million acres under cultivation, corn and soybeans mostly, amber waves of grain. In Illinois, we import 90% of our food from out of state. What that means, if we had a catastrophe, I'm going to let you use your own imagination what that might be, and we couldn't import food, in 3 or 4 days, we in Illinois would run out of food. We need to grow local foods. There is a local movement sprouting up in the Metro East, backyard gardens. I know a number of people now who have their gardens in the back, growing some tomatoes, growing some cucumbers. When you do that, you get some exercise, you get some sunshine, you get to know your neighbors, and this is contagious. Other neighbors start getting interested in a little bit gardening, and you might even share some of those cucumbers or zucchini with your neighbors. I'm still getting used to this of community gardening, where sometimes people are taking a vacant lot, it's been abandoned out there, community people get together and they turn it into a garden. And once again, it's not just the vegetables, they're getting together and getting to know each other in that neighborhood. And I think nothing's better than on a Saturday morning in June, walking down, biking down to the farmer's market and getting some vegetables or fruit, talking to a few farmers, and just as important, talking to a few neighbors out there. Once again, you're building up social capital, that's important. So local food is good for the health of our citizens, our nature, and a local economy. We're doing better, but I think we have a long way to go. And finally, while there can be many principles, the final principle is connecting people and nature together. Richard Love is an author, talks about something called nature deficit disorder. He says children, but I think we adults also suffer it. It means we're not getting outdoor and connecting with nature. We're not getting outdoor experiences. Kids don't go in the backyard and try to dig a hole to China, if you ever remember trying to do that. It was the process, not the goal in the process. You're out there catching butterflies, and now that's probably a taboo thing today, but I think we can still catch fireflies on a warm evening. Children probably don't do that, and we don't play in creeks any longer getting crawdads. Those are good events, but we're picking up values about nature in that process. And I think there's good reasons for that. Our streets are dangerous, that traffic is fast out there. Some of us don't have green spaces available out there. There's a perception of more danger in our community out there. And high tech, the average person, particularly child, will spend 6 hours a day in front of a screen, TV, computer, or cell phone. Technology is not gonna go away, but somehow along with that, we gotta get 1 foot in technology, the other foot in nature out there in the process. Now we're making some good progress. I think, you know, certainly some parents, certainly grandparents, I'm thinking of that story once again that Ben read, the importance of grandparents connecting with their grandkids out there. And community organizations such as Nature Institute and Watershed are getting people out again to play. Green parks, green space, backyards are great places for kids and adults to play, burn off energy, get their bodies moving. Nature is a very good teacher. I hope you get an opportunity today to have a little bit of green time out there. We also need to bring more nature into our community. A native forest or a simple bench under a tree, a butterfly garden on the school playground are all important places, not only for people, but also plants and animals. And sometimes our responsibility is not creating these things. We already have green spaces, and some of us just need to be stewards to make sure these places don't get paved over with concrete. I'm thinking some places where we have a 20 acres of prairie. Nan, I'm thinking about that. If you don't have a steward out there watching on our watch, things can happen to that. Same way with little neighborhood green parks. People must be there to say, you can't pave these or build on these. Reconnecting to nature is an important pathway for restoring healthy communities. It's good for people, good for nature, and good for the local community. If we do these in thousands of communities, I'm hoping that will begin making some change in big ways out there. What attracts people to a place and keeps them are invisible bonds between people and the building landscape and the city's openness to all people. And I hope you kind of begin to think about your community and your place. What is it that drew you to that community, and what's keeping you to that community, and what responsibilities you might have to that community? Every historic building restored, each people-friendly street we create, every tree you and I plant, every public meeting we attend to address racism or sexism, name your own ism on there, contributes to the legacy we leave to those who will live in our communities now, but also after us. Do we not have a moral obligation to hand down a strong, healthy, beautiful place where neighbors can grow? I think we do. And I also left a few pages somewhere else. It's the small things that count that help create a community. I did put a little piece in your service in terms of how to build community. It is biking, walking, at least sometimes. It's growing some of your own tomatoes sometimes. It's creating dialogues with people you know, our strangers. These small things help bring us together in the process. So, get out there and connect with your community.